Perhaps you've heard of Socrates, ancient Greek that we know because Plato recorded in his philosophy writings. Plato recorded dialogues from Socrates. We don't actually have anything of Socrates. But Socrates believed when it came to education that the role was to ask the right questions that unlock the knowledge that already exists, which is what I attempt to do with in my children's time, more or less. And my theory was that this question, what is the really real, makes sense to humans, though they may not have asked themselves that question. And if they sit down, it does hurt your head a little bit to actually try and make sense of it. But when we begin to ask ourselves, well, is a picture more real than the person? No. Does that mean the picture is not real? No, the picture is real. It's just a picture of something. These categories make sense. And religions, all through human culture, have tried to provide an answer to this question of what is the really real. The difficulty is today, in a de-spiritualized or a desacralized culture, that is our Western culture, 21st century, the difficulty is that the question, we've more or less, for all intents and purposes, answered the question, what is the really real, with this answer: what you see is what you get. There's nothing more real than what you can verify through your five senses. The power of science and technology has more or less convinced us that these are the only what science can verify or test is worthy of the claim to be knowledge or truth, or worthy of the claim to be real. We acknowledge that there's all sorts of other things in our world, experiences, emotions, thoughts, other sorts of feelings other than emotions, but we don't give them any substantial reality. Which is why our best response in today's culture, when we're disagreeing with somebody, is to say something like, well, that's nice, dear, that's nice for you, or, I'm sorry, but that's not the way I see it. Because we realize that there's no other court of appeal for these things that can't be touched and tasted. So, you know, is this a book? Yes, most of us would say, especially if you were allowed to come up and grab it, and you would realize it wasn't some sort of fancy holographic presentation. The challenge is that this is not the world as the Bible presents it, and as Christianity over the centuries has taught it. So we are in a bit of an impasse today, or a bit of a crisis, when we read things. I think when we come to a feast day like this, St. Michael's archangel and all angels, unless we go to either Precious Moment figurines or Touched by an Angel, and who is it, Della Rees and company, that has absolutely nothing to do with angels as portrayed in Scripture. If you want a better attempt to begin to grapple with those, you need to go to Madeleine L'Engle in her Wrinkle in Time series, or better yet, I think, C.S. Lewis in his Space Trilogy, where they try to make sense and do a good or an honest job of portraying something that is as greater than you and I as you are to a tadpole or a goldfish. Something in the created world that's a rational being that has power, that has volition, that can act and move and choose. But the difference between that entity and you is the same distance as between you and a tadpole. The tadpole, too, can move and has a will of sorts, we could suggest, and has life, and even has a form of consciousness, one would imagine. And so angels populate and people the universe, depending on, you know, who you read or speculate on, there might be like 100 angels to one human, or who knows how many there are. When the Bible talks about them, they say he's Lord of hosts, God, Yahweh of hosts, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of his warriors, of those who do his will. Now, there's this great picture in Revelation, and this made sense. This doesn't make a lot of sense to us today unless we're thinking, you know, kind of Hollywood presentation or cartoon or comic book. But when John was writing Revelations, the ancient world, when Jesus was a man and walked upon the planet, this made sense. This was the sort of stuff that you could read in the headlines of a newspaper. War in heaven. Archangel Saint Michael, or Archangel Michael kicks some butt. It's a headline. Like, that would have made sense to them. It was the way the universe was. It doesn't make sense to us today. Not that we would disbelieve it. Most of us who call ourselves Christian would say, yes, I believe that there is a spiritual world. I suppose, that there's angels. I believe there's a devil. And I believe, of course, in God, in Jesus, that we say it every Sunday in our creed. But as my university prof, or when I was doing a master's at Carleton, Dr. Gualtieri, who himself had been a preacher, I think he was a United minister, who was now a university prof and an agnostic, if not an atheist, he would begin his world religions class, freshman class, so there'd be 200, 300 kids in this. And he would ask, I think, first of all, if there were any believers in the room, and there would be Sikhs and Muslims as well as Christians and Catholics. Interesting thing is most Catholics don't realize they're Christians. They think Christians are someone different than Catholics. Maybe you've had that conversation with people. News alert, you know, news flash, Catholics are part of the Christian family. Anyway, so maybe some people would raise their hand, I don't remember that part, but do remember this. And Gualtieri would say, well, you don't really believe, you're not really believers, because when you go to write a test, you're going to study, you're not going to pray. To prepare for a test, you're not going to pray, you're going to study. And his point was, that you claim to be a believer, but you live just like everyone else. When the poop hits the fan, you who are a believer in a great ultimate reality that undergirds and supports this present reality, that this present reality is just a sheer, a thin covering on a greater reality. That's what the Christian church teaches, and we claim to believe that. But when the poop hits the fan, we react just like anyone else. We panic, we strategize, we sit down and consolidate our own resources. We cope, we freak out. Now, Gualtieri is overstating the case. And, you know, since I've been a teacher, I realize you often do that. You overstate the case in order that someone might begin to hear what you're saying. But I think he has an interesting point and a valid point. And that is that in 21st century Western North American culture and society, we're virtually all agnostics. We disbelieve in the reality of the spiritual world. There's just nothing in our lives that would point to something that would demonstrate a solid, robust confidence and belief in a greater reality that undergirds and surrounds and supersedes our physical world. So it's a challenge for us, I think, to have a feast day that celebrates angels. Okay, it's a challenge for me. The good thing, I think, from the scriptures is that though this was a world and universe, when scriptures were written, that this made sense. that they never focused on the sensationalism of angels. Even in Revelations, which gets a little more sensational in a lot of ways than most of the rest of the New Testament, at least. We move from a war in heaven, an archangel and angels fighting the dragon, the devil and his forces, and the devil's defeated and cast out of heaven. And then we move to the testimony of the faithful who overcame him by their witness and by the blood of the Lamb. And this is where Christians, the Christian tradition in Scripture, always points us back to Yahweh, the God, our God, the one God, and the one mediator between God and humanity, Jesus. And the salvation that's available there. There's never any hint at glorifying or idolizing angels. And in fact, the first part of Hebrews chapter 1, the author clearly sets out the supremacy of Jesus over angels. And because Jesus, as human, is greater than angels, angels have become ministers of all humans, those who've been called of God, Hebrews chapter 1 tells us. Angels are ministers sent by God for our behalf. And so the first part of the lectionary gives us an interpretive grid for understanding this. First of all, we get the story of Jacob. Jacob's running for his life from Esau. He's tricked Esau out of his blessing from his father, from their father, Isaac. Jacob's not a particularly nice guy, but he is the guy that God has chosen to fulfill his promise to Abraham and to Isaac. Jacob's not a nice guy because he's deceitful and manipulative, because he thinks of Jacob. And he thinks of Jacob, and then he thinks of Jacob. And yet God meets him in this dream, and he dreams there's a ladder placed from heaven to earth, and angels are ascending and descending. There's traffic between heaven and earth. God is in heaven, and God pronounces this blessing upon Jacob. And then John's gospel tells us that this was fulfilled in Jesus. Jacob wakes up, the dream is gone, he's profoundly moved by it, and he marks it, he makes an altar there. It becomes one of the sacred places or the memorable places in Israel's history, Bethel. But the experience or the encounter presumably dissipates over the next several years. And Jacob has another encounter with God as he's returning back from his self-imposed exile, now a wealthy man married with children and servants, to meet his brother Esau and be reconciled. He has another encounter with God. But the New Testament wants us to realize that the promise or what was begun with Jacob has been fulfilled in Jesus. And so at the end of the gospel, Jesus says, and this is presumably an interpretive clue for the rest of the gospel of John, as it is the ending of the introductory statement of the gospel of John, "You will see greater things than this," says Jesus. "You will see heaven opened and the angels ascending and descending on the Son of Man," and Jesus is referring to himself. So what was temporary and given in promise to Jacob, not even really an experience, but a dream he had, is fulfilled in Jesus and becomes a reality. Heaven is open. The gate is swung wide open. Jesus is the ladder by which the blessings of heaven are accessible and available to us as humans. And Jesus is the ladder by which our prayers and petitions and our asking for hope, our asking for help, moves up into heaven. Jesus unites both heaven and earth, and he unites humanity and divinity. And that is not a temporary or momentary experience. That's a fact, Jack. But I don't think that changes the fact that that's very hard for us to believe or accept or live out of. Now, what's the resolution? Well, if I were putting the lectionary together, I would have chosen this, and I was debating to have this as our Old Testament lesson instead of the Genesis, but I saw the tie with, you know, John, and I wanted to keep that. But here's another story from the Old Testament. Elisha, who succeeds Elijah as one of the great prophets in Israel. And there's a neighboring army that's been marauding and pillaging in Israel, and Elisha is alerting the Israelites to this enemy's plans, and he discovers where the leak is, and he's going to go eliminate Elisha and get rid of that leak. And so I'll pick up. This is 2 Kings chapter 6, beginning in verse 15. Now when the attendant of the man of God, Elisha's servant, had risen early and gone out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was circling the city. And his servant said to him, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" And Elisha answered, "Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them or than those who are against us. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them." The servant is obviously confused by this statement. Elisha prayed and said, "O Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see." And the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around them. All around Elisha. Many of us are like this servant. And the words of reassurance and comfort ring hollow or empty in our heart and in our minds. What do you mean, don't be afraid? There are more with us than those who are against us. I can see the army. It's completely surrounded the city. There's you and me. Last counting, that meant two. Two is not more than hundreds or thousands. And Elisha prays, "Lord, open his eyes." And I think that's what we need, is that prayer. When we think about our own lives. But if your experience is anything like mine, that prayer won't be answered the way it was for Elisha's servant. And what I've discovered is that God gave me an intellect with the ability to ask myself if my estimate and assessment of reality is ironclad and is sufficient. Many of us live like Jacob did, self-enclosed in our own interests, in our own desires, and our own wants. Many of us live orbiting and centered around the I or the me, or maybe the us and the ours. And it's no reason, there's no wonder that we think that reality is so small and so limited. We're like people in the Matrix, the film. Or another image, it's like being in a ball or a globe, a sphere that's just out of reach of us. You can never reach the edge because it moves when you move. And there's this vast reality that's just outside the globe. But since you can't see it or touch it or experience it or interact with it, you conclude that all of reality is what's inside the globe. And you become a god in your own little universe, and you decree the reality of what you've experienced. And you defend your right to be God inside your own sphere and to proclaim reality as you've seen it and you've experienced it. But occasionally there are, like Jacob, these little blips, these little things that don't quite fit. And Jacob wakes up having dreamt that heaven was opened and a ladder down and angels ascending and descending, and he's aghast. He's fearful. He's like, what was I thinking? I didn't know God was in this place. And he makes a memorial. But that happened once. 14 years later, plus, Jacob has another encounter with God. But day in, day out, it was the same old Jacob and the same old stuff. And so Jacob has a choice to decide what's more real. And that's the same choice that you and I have. Many of us are self-enclosed in our own reality, defending that reality, defending our right to reign as lords and gods inside our own world. We don't call it that. But we too have had those blips, those invitations to rethink. When God is broken through, when something is just not measured up, and we've said to ourselves, what was I thinking? What was I thinking? Assuming that I was the end-all and be-all of reality, assuming that I was able to dictate reality for myself and for my family, my children, my spouse. And then we have a hot shower, go for a run, and we're like, whew, I'm glad that's over. We make a choice. We make a choice. And when we celebrate St. Michael and all angels, we remind ourselves that if we live in a world that isn't populated by angels, that we've made a choice to live in that world. Instead, when the proverbial brown stuff hits the fan, instead of scrambling and scrabbling like anyone else would, we can stop and say, why would I be afraid? Greater are those who are with me than those who are against me. As a parish, when we look at where our city is going, when we, like I was mentioning last Sunday, the traffic, the incident of homeless people and people that we see and visibly in our society that are destroying their lives through addictions of various forms. And how are we going to respond? And we need an Elisha that says, Lord, open their eyes that they might see, so that we can confidently say, it's no big deal. The resources are here. When we look at paying $180,000 to refinish the outside of our church building, alas, what are we to do? Relax. Greater, more resources, more numerous are those with us than those who are against us. It's not a world, probably, that comes easier natural to us. It's probably not where we live. And I understand that. I do want to remind you that you're complicit in that, at least at some level. That you have made decisions. to get rid of the supernatural and the spiritual in your life. That you've made decisions to see the world as flat, as limited. And so, if it's a choice we've made, it's a choice we can unmake. I would love St. Barnabas to be a parish and a community and a place where our natural instinct was to rejoice in the sufficiency of God when we face challenges. To proclaim and to point and to herald the reality of the spiritual world. And if there are angels, and if they are ministering spirits, then to be a place too where we are actively engaged in that too, in that part as well of God's kingdom and God's universe. Well, may it be so among us. As Christ leads, as Christ continues to unfold his salvation and his purpose in our hearts, in our lives, and among us here at St. Barnabas. Amen.